Chapter 14. Mary worked slowly, taking care to ensure everything was done to the very best of her abilities. There were times when she was impatient to know what Mr. Bennet would think of the little book, but she curbed her desire to make haste, for she had gradually understood the true significance of her task. She had long since ceased to think of it as a simple work of compilation. She knew now it was far more than that. It was a calling card inviting her father to recognize her for who she really was. A like-minded spirit. A daughter it would be easy to love, if only he could be persuaded to notice her. It was this conviction that kept her hard at work, day after day, hour after hour, decorating the margins and ornamenting each page with coloured flourishes. She would spare nothing to make her book of extracts the most accomplished of its kind. One cold day, when unseasonal showers kept all but the bravest indoors, for once, Mary was not alone in the library. Whilst she sat at her table, her papers spread out around her, Elizabeth perched in the window seat, knees drawn up before her, a book in her hand. She knew the rules that governed visitors to Mr. Bennet's library as well as anyone, and for much of the time she was obediently silent. But every so often a little chuckle of amusement escaped her, until finally she could not help herself and laughed out loud. Mary looked up, shocked at such a breach of discipline, but Lizzie merely smiled, offering her father an apology that was anything but abject.
"I'm sorry, Papa. I didn't mean to disturb you."
Mr. Bennet took off his spectacles and gazed at Elizabeth with such warmth that Mary's heart contracted. Perhaps once he had read her extracts, he might look at her in the same way.
"What are you reading, my dear, that pleases you so much?"
"It's Miss Burnley's Evelina. I've read it so often, and yet it never fails to make me laugh."
Mr. Bennet put down his book.
"And which parts of it do you find most amusing?"
"The comic characters are very well done, but I think I enjoy those moments where the humour is entirely unintended. Who wouldn't smile at a hero who is not only single and strikingly handsome, but is also conveniently possessed of £10,000 a year? And who could fail to be amused by a heroine wise enough to unite in her person outstanding beauty and a mind so superior that the hero is quite prepared to overlook the vulgarity of her birth?"
She closed the book, her expression alive with pleasure.
"I'm only surprised it took them so long to realise they were destined for one another. I should have thought such a remarkable pair would have recognised their fate in 10 pages at most. So yes, I laugh. But I must confess, I envy them their cheerful conclusion. If only real life were like that."
"That is just the kind of happy ending I should wish for you, Lizzie," declared her father softly. "I would arrange it myself if it lay within my power."
"You need not fear for me, Papa," she replied. "I am much more sensible than I look. I am quite prepared, I promise you, to settle for something, or perhaps I should say someone, far more ordinary than Miss Burney's hero."
It was painful for Mary to watch the intimacy between Elizabeth and their father, and know she was excluded from it. The affection that flowed so easily between them was exactly what she yearned to experience for herself. She stared down at the notes laid out in careful order on her table, at the books marked with slips of paper to remind her of passages she had enjoyed. That was the purpose of all this work. That was why she applied herself so tirelessly day after day. All she wanted was to see Mr. Bennet look at her with even a hint of the tenderness which he now directed at Lizzie. But she must not let her mind run in that direction. It would only upset and distract her. She must concentrate on something less distressing. She watched as Lizzie took up her book again. It was a long time since Mary had read a novel. It did not surprise her that Mrs. Bennet enjoyed them, but she found it hard to believe that Elizabeth, with her quick understanding, regarded such works so indulgently.
"But Lizzie," she ventured, "if you think so little of these books, why do you continue to read them?"
"You quite mistake my meaning," replied Elizabeth. "These are loving criticisms on my part. For all the little faults in Evelina, I shall always be its firm friend."
"But aren't you wasting time that might be better employed elsewhere? Dr. Fordyce says novels are very unsuitable for women to read. Their morals often leave much to be desired. They have nothing of worth to tell us, and they convey no proper instruction.
Elizabeth sat up straight, serious now.
For me, that is one of their chief recommendations. I do not care to be told what to think at every turn of a page. And I do not agree that they have nothing to tell us. Is Charles Grandison to be thus dismissed? Tristram Shandy? Tom Jones? Works in which the most thorough knowledge of human nature is displayed? The greatest powers of the mind described? No, I cannot sit by and leave the novel undefended.
Mary searched through her notes, hunting for a favourite quotation.
Dr. Fordyce says books of history and philosophy are more useful for a female mind. They enhance our understanding, whilst novels only arouse our passions. I cannot see why a woman of sense shouldn't enjoy both. I should consider it an insult to be denied the pleasures afforded me by Miss Burney, because it might make me less receptive to those of Mr. Hume. Dr. Fordyce, however, I leave to you. I shall not compete for his company.
Mr. Bennet, who had been watching the conversation with interest, laughed out loud at this.
Well said, Lizzie. Well said indeed. And you are quite right about Fordyce. Milk and water stuff. All cant and obsequiousness. Not worthy of serious notice.
Mary looked down, unable to bear the affectionate smiles that passed between her father and sister. She knew Lizzie had routed her, but the humiliation of her defeat was as nothing to the pain she felt in hearing her favourite Dr. Fordyce spoken of by Mr. Bennet with such disdain. It had never occurred to her that her father would not share her appreciation for Dr. Fordyce's ideas. Elizabeth slipped off the window seat, readying herself to leave. Generous in victory, she held out her book to her sister.
"Shall I leave you my copy of Evelina, Mary? I think you might enjoy it if you would allow yourself to do so."
"I shall try it if you wish," replied Mary in a low voice. When she did not reach up to take the book from her sister's hand, Elizabeth laid it amongst the other volumes on the table, where Mary noticed it quite obscured her well-thumbed copy of Dr. Fordyce. Once Elizabeth had gone, Mr. Bennet turned back to his own reading, a very faint expression of pleasure just visible on his face. Mary sat thinking for a few minutes. When she spoke, her voice seemed very loud in the silent room.
"Papa," she ventured, "may I ask you a question?"
Her father started up, as if surprised to find her still there.
"Do you really think so meanly of Dr. Fordyce? I have been studying him for some time."
"I'm afraid those are unlikely to have been hours well spent. I consider him a tedious, unprofitable read, but you may have reached other conclusions."
"Can I ask your opinion of other books I've been looking into? Blair's Sermons, Paley's Evidences of Christianity, Hannah More on Female Education?"
"Well, Paley is at least a proper thinker. I suppose you may derive some benefit from what he has to say. The others are quite worthless, unless you have a taste for arid morality and pompous sentiment of the most obvious kind."
Mary closed her eyes for a moment, trying to gather her thoughts. She had clearly made a great error in judgment. How could she have been so foolish as to imagine Mr. Bennet would approve of the authors whose words she had been copying out so carefully and with such keen expectation?
"If you don't approve of the writers I have chosen, can you suggest any whom you value that you think I might enjoy?"
"I'm not sure I should venture to do so. Your tastes seem very strenuous for so young a girl. They don't seem to tend much towards the light, bright or cheerful."
"No, Papa, I don't think they do. I wish to be informed, not entertained."
"Indeed. Well, the best advice I can give you is to follow your own instincts. They will be a far better guide than anything I can suggest. One way or another, they will direct you towards what you require."
He picked up his book again, and Mary knew she was dismissed. She gathered together her papers, closed the door of the library, and walked to her bedroom. She understood now that the book of extracts over which she had laboured with such care was quite useless.
Mr. Bennet would find nothing in it to admire. Every writer she had included was regarded by him with contempt. Sitting at her writing desk, she turned the pages of the little book, looking at the entries she had made with such hope that had cost her so many hours of ungrudged effort. A loving father would have been pleased with the gift regardless of its contents, because his child had taken the trouble to make it. But Mary knew Mr. Bennet would not be so indulgent.
It would do nothing to raise her in his estimation. On the contrary, it would confirm his opinion of her silliness, of her unworthiness to be noticed, valued, or loved.
It would certainly not persuade him to look at her as he did Lizzie. Stone-faced, she opened the drawer of the dressing table, placed the book of extracts within it, and slammed it shut. Chapter 15. With no task to work upon, Mary found it difficult to fill the long hours that stretched before her each day. She read until her eyes ached, but she struggled to summon the enthusiasm that had once driven her excitedly onwards. She practiced at the piano until her fingers grew stiff, and when they would no longer obey her, she went out, walking along the familiar path into Meryton. No one offered to accompany her, and she did not seek out a companion. On her return, she was not asked where she had been or what she had done. At mealtimes, the conversation ebbed and flowed around the table, rarely requiring a response from her. She had nothing to add to Lydia's and Kitty's breathless reports of the comings and goings of their favourite officers, or to her mother's confidential account of her sister Phillips's new housemaid. She never again attempted to join in any of the conversations between Mr. Bennet and Elizabeth. Mostly she sat silent, paying little attention to what was being said. So at first she barely noticed her mother's announcement that the neighbouring house of Netherfield had been let at last. But Mrs. Bennet was so excited by the news, and returned to it so often, that soon even Mary was aware that a young man of large fortune had arrived from the north of England in a chaise, taken one look at Netherfield, and agreed to terms on the spot. It appeared the new tenant's name was Bingley, and that he was single, although her mother was determined he should not remain in that state for long.
"You must know,"
Mrs. Bennet informed her husband one morning at the breakfast table,
"that I am thinking of his marrying one of our girls."
"Do you really imagine," he replied evenly, "that his principal intention in settling here was to choose a wife from amongst our daughters? It seems an unlikely inducement for signing a year's lease, even on the most advantageous terms, especially as he has yet to set eyes upon any of them."
"That will be quickly remedied if you will go and call upon him. Once you have introduced yourself, there's nothing to stop us making a visit. But we can't do that until you've seen him. It wouldn't be polite."
"I'm not sure I agree. Why should we make ourselves the prisoners of custom? I see no reason why you and the girls shouldn't call whenever you choose. Or perhaps they should go alone. You're still as handsome as any of them, and Mr. Bingley might like you the best of the party."
Mrs. Bennet was not to be deflected by compliments, however justified she felt them to be.
"Oh, come, Mr. Bennet, you know we can't go unless you do. It would seem very odd indeed."
"You may have a point. Perhaps it would be simpler if I wrote to Mr. Bingley, giving my consent in advance to his marrying whichever of our daughters he preferred. That might save a great deal of time and trouble. He could have any of them he wished, though I must throw in a word for my little Lizzie."
"I'm sure it's very unkind of you to tease me in this way. If you won't call, others will not be so delicate. What if Sir William Lucas gets there before you? Will it make you happy to see Charlotte Lucas established at Netherfield? Every moment you delay might be of consequence."
Mr. Bennet leant back in his chair, satisfied now that his wife was thoroughly agitated.
"I admit you are faced with a dilemma. What is to take precedence, the claims of proper behaviour or the prospect of losing so promising a son-in-law? I'm not sure I can advise you. What say you, Mary? You are a young lady of deep reflection, I know, and read great books and make extracts."
Mary looked up, astonished. Surprise forced every intelligent response from her mind, and she could think of nothing to say. Her father stared at her for a moment, deeply amused, before turning his attention back towards his wife.
Whilst Mary is adjusting her ideas, let us return to Mr. Bingley.
As her parents resumed their bickering, Mary sat stupefied. It was surely not possible Mr. Bennet had been aware of the little book she had intended to present to him. No, she had shown it to no one, and it still lay safe in her drawer, his name on the front page, accompanied by a dedication he would never now see. He had perhaps noticed the hours she spent in his library, copying out quotations, but he could know nothing of the purpose towards which her work had been directed. It was painfully evident from his arch expression that she had been right not to show it to him. He would not have valued it. Her scholarly ambitions were as ridiculous to him as the hours Kitty and Lydia spent decorating hats or discussing the merits of shoe buckles. Mary's spirits were lower than usual at supper and at breakfast the next day. Her father's disdain weighed heavily on her, and for as long as Mr. Bingley remained the principal subject of conversation, she had nothing to say. Then, on the third evening, the mood around the table suddenly lifted. Her mother beamed. Lydia and Kitty laughed and poked each other. Even Mr. Bennet looked pleased, entirely satisfied with a tease which had delivered everything he could have wished. It was soon apparent that while strenuously maintaining to his family that he would not call upon Mr. Bingley, Mr. Bennet had, in fact, made his way to Netherfield that very morning and paid his respects. He had always intended to go, but he had resolved not to deny himself the pleasure of provoking his wife by telling her so. Mrs. Bennet did not care. She was delighted that the first obstacle to the marriage of one of her daughters to Mr. Bingley had been surmounted, and she did not doubt any further difficulties would be conquered with equal ease. A few days later, Mr. Bingley himself arrived at Longbourn to return Mr. Bennet's visit. But to Mrs. Bennet's extreme frustration, no one except her husband was admitted to his presence. He remained closeted in the library, and the only glimpse to be had of him by the female part of the family was from a first-floor window as he rode away, from which all that could be discerned was that he wore a blue jacket and rode a black horse. When taxed by his wife with inhuman disregard for her feelings in not introducing Mr. Bingley to her, Mr. Bennet replied that the young man had business in London and had not the time for the pleasure of a meeting.
But he was most insistent I should pass on his apologies to you and all the young ladies of the household. He added that he hopes to have the pleasure of seeing us all at the next Meryton Assembly, which he is determined to attend. And, as two of his sisters will accompany him, alongside some other friends and relations, he looks forward to introducing them into your company as well as himself. A rather exhaustingly polite young man, in my opinion.
Kitty and Lydia cheered out loud at this news. Once they had satisfied themselves that Mr. Bingley was not in the militia and did not wear a uniform, their interest in him waned somewhat. But the arrival of other young men was a prospect that could only be greeted with enthusiasm, for it was entirely possible that amongst them might be officers. Chapter 16. As the assembly was only a few weeks away, Mrs. Hill was soon hard at work, cleaning, repairing, taking in and letting out, doing all she could to ensure that the Longbourn outfits were fit to be seen alongside the metropolitan fashions which were to be worn by Mr. Bingley's female guests. One evening, as she came into her bedroom, Mary found Mrs. Hill examining the new dress she had bought for the last ball, brushing down its neat bodice and shaking out its cream and gold skirts. "Shall you wear it, do you think? This would be very much the right occasion to show it off again." "It didn't bring me much luck on its last outing." Mrs. Hill put down the dress and sat on the bed. "I saw Mr. Sparrow in Meryton last week. He told me Johnny's gone off, headed for London to become a doctor. He stopped me in the street as pleased as anything. He's sure the boy'll end up with a practice in town. Appointments at a guinea a time. And his own carriage waiting at the door." Mary walked to the window, She did not want Mrs. Hill to see the regret she suspected must be only too plainly written on her face. There was no chance now of apologizing for her behavior. She would never be able to make amends for the way she had treated him.
"What I mean by telling you," continued Mrs. Hill, "is that you don't need to fret about seeing him again at the assembly."
She picked up the dress and placed it carefully on a hanger.
"He is a sweet-tempered lad, but not right for you."
"He was kind and generous and seemed to enjoy my company. That was pleasure enough for me."
"Your parents would never have stood for it."
Mary considered this. Her father, she thought, with his contrary spirit, might have enjoyed watching such an unlikely connection unfold, relishing the opportunities it offered to exercise his wit at the expense of all concerned. Her mother, however, would never have appreciated the joke. She would have opposed it with all the considerable reserves of outrage at her command, and hers would have been the last word on the matter, at least until young Mr. Sparrow, the oculist's assistant, had transformed himself into Dr. Sparrow, the wealthy physician.
"Perhaps I was simply unfortunate in my timing. If Mr. Sparrow had been already in possession of that carriage you mentioned, then things might have been very different."
Mrs. Hill shrugged.
"That's the way of the world, I'm afraid."
"All we did was dance together. I didn't want to marry him, you know. How could I when I hardly know him? I merely liked talking to him. No one has ever sought me out before or listened with interest to anything I say. He noticed me and made me laugh, and for that he earned the contempt of everyone around me. And I was so swayed by their prejudice that I crumpled up and ran away. That was a fine return for his kindness."
"Well, what's done is done."
Mrs. Hill stood up. She had work to do, and they could hear Lydia's impatient voice in the hall.
"Far worse things have happened, and men and women have lived to tell the tale. But I hope you'll go to the assembly and not stay at home brooding over what can't be altered.
And I think you should wear the new dress. It suits you, and it's wasted hanging in the wardrobe."
Over the next few days, Mary's thoughts blew this way and that, uncertain whether she would follow Mrs. Hill's advice or not. Sometimes she quailed at the prospect of another ball, having experienced at first hand the dangers and humiliations that lay in wait for the unwary. But another part of her bridled at the idea of hiding herself away. She suspected if she did not go, it would become easier to refuse the next time and the next, until she turned herself into a complete recluse. No, however reluctant she was, she must go. But although she eventually persuaded herself it was right to attend, nothing could convince Mary to wear the golden cream gown. Its delicate prettiness did not suit her mood. Instead, ignoring Mrs. Hill's pleas, she put on a plain dress and twisted her hair into an unbecoming knot at the back of her head. When she glanced in the mirror, she saw a colourless figure, her face pale, her clothes drab. There was nothing about her to attract anyone's attention. Even to herself, she seemed almost invisible. For a few moments, she looked at her reflection without expression. Then she slipped her spectacles into a little bag. There was no reason not to take them. She said little on the journey into Meryton, but her mother and sisters more than made up for her silence. Kitty and Lydia, determined not to sit out a single dance, were already arguing about whom they should dance with and in what order. Mrs. Bennet was vocal in her eagerness to set eyes at last upon Mr. Bingley, and declared herself almost as keen to meet the rest of his party, for who knew if it might not contain another eligible young man. Jane and Elizabeth refused to speculate about what the ball might promise, but Mary thought she caught even them in a sense of excitement. Only she felt nothing at all as the carriage pulled into the village. Chapter 17. The Meryton rooms were as hot and as crowded as she remembered them. The green boughs on the walls were just as charming, the candles just as numerous, and, as the strong smell of tallow suggested, bought just as cheaply as before. Through the great double doors she saw, as she had done before, a generous supper being laid out, and in the centre of the ballroom, couples were beginning to take their places for the next dance. It was all as it had been when she was last there, but this time she knew better where she belonged. She walked decidedly towards the chairs where the mothers, aunts, and grandmothers had established themselves, and looked for a place to sit amongst them. Her sisters claimed seats here too, but Mary knew they would use them only as perches to rest upon between dances, poised to be seen to most advantage before another partner presented himself and whisked them away. Mary, who suspected her stay would be of longer duration, settled on a chair set a little way from the front where she hoped to feel less exposed. Here for some 30 minutes she remained, uninvited to join the lively throng on the dance floor. As she sat, her eyes strayed upwards to the musicians on the balcony, playing with such energy that she could almost feel the heat of their efforts. Perhaps, she thought, that was where she should be, occupied in a task she enjoyed, safely removed from the probability of failure below. As she brooded, however, she became conscious of a ripple of interest in the conversations around her, a twitter of activity amongst the seated mothers. Following their glances, nods, and gestures, peering across the room, she saw that a small party of people had arrived and stood surveying the scene. She did not recognise any amongst them, but their clothes and bearing suggested there could be no doubt who they were. Mr. Bingley and his friends had arrived at last. Mr. Bingley, for as he stood at the front of the little group, urging them forward, there could be little doubt of his identity, was a good-looking young man, with a cheerful, engaging expression. Behind him stood two women dressed in the first fashion, who Mary concluded must be his sisters. They looked less eager than their brother to plunge into the crowded room. Neither smiled. Two further gentlemen accompanied them. One, who was later discovered to be the husband of the eldest sister, was not much noticed, but the other quickly drew the attention of everyone in the room. He was tall, he was handsome, and he was known to be the possessor of a fine estate in Derbyshire. For a while, his appearance and his history attracted the approval of the men and alerted the interest of the women. But Mr. Darcy's manners soon turned the tide of his popularity. His expression was grave and severe. He made no effort to conciliate the assembly, and, unlike his friend, seemed to take no pleasure in his situation. Mr. Bingley's willingness to please and be pleased was much to be preferred. He allowed himself to be introduced to as many people as wished to meet him, praised the look of the rooms, the liveliness of the music, and the prospect of supper. And when he made known his intention to dance every dance, his ascendancy over his remote and silent friend was complete. It did not escape notice that Mr. Darcy took to the floor only with the women of his own party, whilst Mr. Bingley chose his partners from amongst the Meryton ladies. Mary watched as he led Charlotte Lucas onto the floor. This was an unexpected gesture. His choice of her sister Jane for the next dance seemed far more in keeping with the natural order of things. Jane, she thought, looked particularly handsome, her cool, unruffled beauty appearing to great advantage amidst the noise and heat of the ball. Bingley danced with her with obvious enjoyment, and seemed reluctant to let her go, claiming her company after the set was over and talking to her with great animation, as Jane modestly looked away from his appraising smiles. "He will ask her again," thought Mary. "If not now, then later. This will be a triumphant night for Jane." She was surprised when Charlotte Lucas sat down next to her. Mary had avoided her since the last ball. She did not doubt that the fault for what had happened then was in most respects her own, but she thought Charlotte a little guilty too. Had there been a hint of relish in the way she had delivered her warning about John Sparrow? A touch of jealousy in her insistence that Mary abandon him? These were unworthy thoughts which Mary was ashamed to entertain, but as she had been unable yet to drive them from her mind, she had chosen not to put herself in Charlotte's company until she could get the better of them. However, as Charlotte greeted her with every appearance of friendship, Mary resolved to do all she could to return it in good faith. "You have tucked yourself away in a very secluded place here," she began. "Is this a wise decision?
No one will ask you to dance if you are invisible to the human eye." She smiled as she spoke, but behind her good humour her face was taut. "Oh, I'm quite well where I am. I can see everything here. I don't miss a thing." "I'm not sure that's quite true. Watching what happens isn't the same as being part of it. You are missing something, of that you can be sure." "This feels like the best place for me." "Perhaps if you have already decided to withdraw from the fray." Unsettled by the turn of the conversation, Mary tried a lighter tone. "Well, your own good fortune won't have gone unnoticed tonight. You were the first woman Mr. Bingley stood up with. What an honour to be marked out in such a way." She tried to sound as sincere and as playful as she could. She did not much care for Charlotte, but she did not like to see her in so bleak a mood. Charlotte looked towards the dance floor where Mr. Bingley was leading Jane out again for a second dance. "Yes," she replied thoughtfully. "I was the polite choice, the evidence, if you like, of his good manners and willingness to charm us all. But he didn't look at me as he already looks at Jane." Mary followed Charlotte's glance. It was true. Mr. Bingley was now utterly absorbed with her sister, his eyes following her as she moved up the line of dancers. "I know very well what I must do and say next," continued Charlotte. "I must smile and nod and look unconcerned at my dismissal, whilst laughing and teasing Jane about her new conquest. And that is what I will do. I'm used to it. But I tell you what it is, Mary, I'm not sure if I can do it for much longer." Mary shifted uneasily in her seat. Charlotte's sudden candour disturbed her, and she was uncertain how to respond. "I am nearly 27 years old. I have been coming to balls like this for 10 years, and not once has anyone looked at me with the admiration Mr. Bingley is now directing at Jane. Not once have I been the one around whom other women gather, congratulating, exclaiming. No, it is always my lot to cheer on the triumphs of my friends." She pulled at her gloves distractedly. "Lord knows, I don't expect much, but I should like to have something of my own before it is too late. Some mark of affection, some sign I have been wanted and preferred." "You have parents who love you," ventured Mary, "and brothers and sisters to care for." "Yes," replied Charlotte, "and I know that should be enough, but with every day that goes past, I find that it isn't quite." Mary moved her hand uncertainly towards Charlotte's arm. She did not trust herself to speak, recognizing in Charlotte's words the same fears that had begun to loom large in her own darker moments. What if no one ever wanted her? Her spirits fell as she looked around the room. None of the men she saw there seemed likely to prefer her to the prettier, louder, livelier women who paraded and coquetted about the floor with so much confidence. This was only her second ball, and she already felt she had failed. Could she endure a decade of humiliation and rejection with the fortitude Charlotte had shown? Mary withdrew her hand, afraid her touch might provoke in Charlotte an outpouring of emotion to which Mary would not know how to respond. She felt the power of Charlotte's despair, and it saddened her. But then Charlotte looked up and arranged her features into her usual expression of pleasant expectation. "But here comes Lizzie, and at just the right moment to dispel this gloom." Mary screwed up her eyes, just as John Sparrow had told her not to, and spotted Elizabeth winding her way through the stragglers at the edge of the dance floor, striding towards them. With the briefest of acknowledgements, she pulled a chair towards them. "I have such a tale to relate that it really wouldn't wait, so I came straight to find you. It can't be said to reflect particularly well on me, but it is so good a joke that I've decided to purchase your laughter at the expense of my dignity, such as it is." Before Mary or Charlotte could reply, she raced on with her account. It appeared that as the previous dance began, she had had no partner. That may be said to have been the first of my misfortunes, and was compelled to sit and watch the proceedings from a seat some rows back from the dance floor. She had been there only a few minutes when she noticed Mr. Bingley and his tall friend approach and stand before her. She had not meant to listen to their conversation, but really they spoke so decidedly that it was impossible to ignore.
Thus, willingly or not, she had heard Mr. Bingley berating Mr. Darcy for his reluctance to dance. The room, he insisted, was full of charming women, any one of whom would be delighted to stand up with him. Why did he not ask some fortunate girl to be his partner? It did not reflect well on him to hold himself so aloof. It made no sense to march about the room with such an obvious determination not to be pleased.
"I could not wait to hear how he would answer such a very justified rebuke," continued Elizabeth. "But he was not in the least mortified, replying with some warmth that Mr. Bingley had danced with the only handsome girl in the room, by which he meant Jane, of course. But his friend was not prepared to surrender his point so easily. Whilst he agreed that Jane was indeed the most beautiful creature he ever beheld, and please note those were his actual words, he persevered, with perhaps more gallantry than tact. What about her sister, he asked. She is pretty enough and not engaged. Should he like to be introduced to me?
Lizzie paused for a moment to take a breath.
And then this proud man, I think we all now know his name is Darcy, turns and looks me straight in the eye and says, and I will do him the justice to believe he didn't think I could hear him,
she is tolerable, but not handsome enough to tempt me.
She turned from Mary to Charlotte, laughing.
What do you think? Is that not the most extraordinary thing you have heard?
Well, it is justly said that listeners never hear good of themselves, said Mary.
If that is the case, then I have certainly been properly punished, declared Elizabeth. Tolerable, indeed! Was there ever such a milk-and-water insult as that?
Not handsome enough to tempt me.
As though we women have no other occupation than to lay ourselves out to be agreeable to him.
It does suggest a good deal of presumption on his part, mused Charlotte.
Yes, but I am glad of it, for it has enabled me to decide my opinion of him. I was not sure what to think at first when I heard him so complained of for his coldness and his want of common courtesy, for by then I had only seen his bad behaviour. But now that I have heard for myself that he is just as disagreeable as he appears to be, I shall have no hesitation in condemning him out of hand.
Charlotte smiled consolingly.
I am sorry you've been so disappointed in your new acquaintance, Lizzie, but it does not look as though his indifference has pierced your heart very deeply. No, I dare say I shall survive it.
Lizzie stood up and surveyed the room.
I only regret that I am unlikely to have the opportunity of paying him back in kind. I really would delight in seeing his pride somewhat humbled. But I don't think our paths will cross again. And, as I'm sure Mary would agree, there is little point in hankering after what we cannot have, so I shan't brood on the wrong done to me. I will go instead in search of something to drink and a partner who I hope will have the good taste to find me more than merely tolerable, or will at least refrain from expressing any contrary opinion until he's well out of earshot.
Ah, Lizzie will never be short of admirers, observed Charlotte as they watched her walk away. She will always attract notice wherever she goes.
It is impossible to be indifferent to her, agreed Mary. When she's in a room, you always know she's there. Even when she says nothing at all, she looks as though she might, and that is bound to be something witty. Whereas you and I, please do not take it ill of me if I say that I don't think people wait with the same eagerness to hear what we say next, we do not sparkle as she does.
Mary looked gloomily at the skirts of her colourless dress. Perhaps she should have worn the gold gown. If no one else had noticed it, it might nevertheless have made her feel less insipid.
No, I don't suppose they do.
They sat quietly, each contemplating the gulf of pleasure and possibility that lay between themselves and Elizabeth. Finally, Charlotte spoke, in a voice of quiet determination that Mary had not heard her use before. I'll tell you a secret, Mary. I've made a promise to myself that I will not come to another of these balls as an unmarried woman. If I am still single by this time next year, I intend to put on a cap and declare myself an old maid.
Really, Charlotte, what can you mean? I see that you're in low spirits tonight, but that's far too significant a step to be taken without very serious consideration. Have you discussed it with Lizzie? Of course not. She would never understand. But I think you might. And I hope you will allow me to explain myself a little.
I am happy to listen if you wish me to do so. Charlotte stared into the distance,
her expression unreadable. When I was about your age, I imagined marriage was a reward for good behaviour and patience. I thought that if I was good and obliging and did as I was told, it was inevitable that I should end up as someone's wife. If it didn't happen this year, then surely it would in the next. But I waited and waited and smiled, and yet here I am, a single woman still.
And is that so terrible a fate? Ventured Mary.
When one looks at how some husbands and wives live together, it doesn't seem as though marriage always brings happiness.
You cannot seriously think that the life of an old maid is to be preferred, cried Charlotte with some vehemence. Think of the unmarried women of your acquaintance, living on whatever their families allow them, eking out their subsistence with a few piano lessons or a little discreet dressmaking, mocked and disdained by all. No, for an educated woman, brought up to be genteel as we have been, the future holds no prospect but marriage or misery, depend upon it.
But if that's your opinion, why are you so willing to embrace a life you despise? To put on your cap, as you say, and abandon yourself to an existence you believe intolerable.
I suppose I dangle such a dreadful prospect before myself to concentrate my mind on the alternative. I know I am approaching the years of danger. I must act soon, or not at all.
I'm not sure I understand you, said Mary. In what possible way can you act? Do you mean to go around asking men to marry you?
No, replied Charlotte ruefully. I haven't arrived at that degree of boldness quite yet, but I won't disguise from you that I'm prepared to do everything I can, within the bounds of propriety, of course, to find a respectable man to be my husband. If such a one were to cross my path tomorrow, I should not answer for his chances of escaping me.
Her tone was light-hearted, but Mary did not doubt for a moment that she meant all she said.
I sometimes think, Charlotte continued, that for some men, especially those without much experience of society, it must be a great relief when a woman throws off discretion and doesn't hesitate to convey how readily she would agree to become his wife. It must be a terrible thing not to know before you ask what the answer to a proposal of marriage is likely to be. The certainty of acceptance must be a tremendous encouragement to the making of an offer.
You say nothing at all of love. Do you really think it a good idea to marry where there is no affection?
Well, I am not romantic, you know. The last 10 years have cured me of that. I am not Lizzie, who will always be sought after. Women like me, who aren't overburdened with the choice of suitors, must learn to discipline their feelings. I'm sure I would settle now for anyone with a little money of his own who wasn't positively unkind. I no longer look for a great love. Comfortable home and the security of a proper settlement is all I ask.
She turned to look directly at Mary.
I hope I haven't shocked you. I have been brooding on these things for so long that it is a great relief to open my mind and speak about them to someone. And for all kinds of reasons, I thought you might understand how I have come to think as I do.
You are certainly very frank.
Yes, I have spoken very plainly, and not only because it was a pleasure to talk honestly for once of matters which are not usually discussed. Charlotte's usual half-smile had disappeared. She was entirely serious now.
I suppose I also thought you might learn something from my experience and apply it to your own future prospects. I'm offering you advice, if you wish to take it. So, don't waste time, as I have done, waiting for something to happen. Fortune really does favour the brave, you know. Don't believe you can find happiness celebrating the good fortune of others. An eternity spent smiling and cooing over the good luck of your friends makes the heart sick in the end. And above all, don't long for what you cannot have, but learn to recognise what is possible, and when it presents itself, seize upon it with both hands. It seems to me this is the only route to happiness for those of us born with neither beauty, riches, nor charm.
Charlotte reached for the little bag at her feet. There! What a collection of portentous observations! I don't imagine your favourite Dr. Fordyce would approve, but then he has not the knowledge of the world that I have.
She stood up, all briskness now, and readied herself to leave.
I'm not at all surprised, after such a lengthy confession, to find myself extremely hungry. I shall go and see if I can hunt down Lizzie and compel her to the supper table. She did not ask Mary to accompany her, nor did she look back as she made her way towards the dining room. For the rest of the evening, Charlotte's unexpected declaration occupied Mary's mind. She thought about it as she sat eating an ice with her mother. When she picked up the printed programme for the evening, put on her glasses, and appeared to be studying it, Charlotte's words rang in her ears. She was still considering them when, to her surprise, she heard her own name mentioned. When she turned to see who had spoken, she saw Lady Lucas a few footsteps away, eagerly pointing out to Mr. Bingley's sisters those of the Bennet family to whom they had not yet been introduced.
"And lastly, of course," declared Lady Lucas, "there is Miss Mary Bennet, the most accomplished girl in the neighbourhood."
Before she knew it, Mary's eyes met those of the younger Bingley sister, who bobbed the smallest possible curtsy in acknowledgement. "That is a great achievement, to be sure," she said, "and one which, judging by appearances, is very much deserved." Flustered, Mary stood and curtsied back. "I honour your commitment to learning," Miss Bingley continued smoothly. "Study clearly trumps all other considerations in your mind. You are an example to us all." Lady Lucas smiled, and the Bingley sisters swept away. It was only once they had gone that Mary realized she was still wearing her spectacles. Chapter 18. No ball can be properly considered over until every detail of the evening has been thoroughly examined, weighed, and dissected the day after the event. And it was a sign of how much there was to discuss that breakfast was barely cleared away at Longbourn when a party of Lucases arrived to begin the discussions.
"You began the evening well, Charlotte," said Mrs. Bennet. "You were Mr. Bingley's first choice."
"Yes, but he seemed to like his second better."
"Oh,"
declared Mrs. Bennet with an unconvincing attempt at surprise.
"You mean Jane, I suppose, because he danced with her twice? To be sure, it did seem as if he admired her."
"Indeed he did," continued Charlotte. "In fact, as I think I told you, I heard him mention that he thought her quite the prettiest woman in the room."
"You may have said so," agreed Mrs. Bennet, "but I am glad to hear you confirm it. I believe he remarked that there could be no two opinions on that point. He did say so, did he not?"
Charlotte agreed those had indeed been Mr. Bingley's words. Mrs. Bennet did not attempt to disguise her satisfaction that her eldest daughter had been so publicly preferred to Charlotte. She looked from her to Lady Lucas with unconcealed joy. Although she watched her carefully, Mary could not detect any waver in Charlotte's fixed smile, no crack in her expression of mild, good-natured resignation. "My overhearings were more to the purpose than yours, Lizzie," Charlotte continued playfully. "Poor Eliza, to be considered only tolerable."
"It is a great snub,"
agreed Elizabeth with mock gravity, "but I must endeavour to bear it." Mrs. Bennet was not so easily placated. She could not regard the disparagement of her daughters as anything other than a grievous insult. But what was to be expected of a man whose behaviour had attracted such universal disapproval? Mr. Darcy had shown himself to be disagreeable, everyone had said so. It was obvious to all that he was an unpleasant man, haughty, cold, reserved, and eaten up with pride. Mrs. Bennet declared Lizzie was to take no notice of him.
"If you were to meet again, and he asked you to stand up with him, I hope you would say no."
"I believe, Mamma, I may safely promise, I will never dance with him." The conversation ran back and forth, with Mr. Darcy's person, manners, and character all weighed up and found wanting. It was some time before Mrs. Bennet was ready to return to the more gratifying topic of Jane's success with Mr. Bingley, but before she could do so, Mary spoke.
"I wonder if we are quite fair to condemn Mr. Darcy as quickly as we do. There is a difference, you know, between pride and vanity. One is much more to be condemned than the other. The vain man wants others to think well of himself, regardless of his virtues. Pride relates more to our honest opinion of ourselves."
She looked around searchingly at her listeners, hoping for a reply, but no one, it seemed, had anything to add to her remark.
Is it not possible, she persisted, that Mr. Darcy has some justification for his self-belief? Perhaps he has a right to be proud. Mrs. Bennet threw up her hands in exasperation.
Really, Mary, none of us needs a lecture on what to think of that man. We have all made up our minds and don't require any further direction from you.
Mary blushed, realizing she had once again struck the wrong note. There was silence until a young Lucas brother, who had reluctantly accompanied his sister and mother to Longbourn on the promise of cake, which had not yet been forthcoming, piped up.
If I were as rich as Mr. Darcy, I should not care how proud I was. I should keep a pack of foxhounds and drink a bottle of wine every day.
Mrs. Bennet assured him that if she were to see him at it, she would take away his bottle directly. He said she should not. She insisted that she would. And soon the level of talk was as loud and as lively as it had been before Mary had spoken. When the Lucases finally took their leave, Charlotte stopped for a moment by her side. Our interventions are only welcome if they are agreeable, she murmured. And by that, I mean that they reflect what everyone else thinks and are delivered with a most submissive smile. Chapter 19. When Sir William Lucas announced his plan to give a sociable little dinner, it came as an unwelcome surprise to Mrs. Bennet. She had not anticipated that the Lucases would seize the opportunity to invite Mr. Bingley, along with his friends, to meet the families of the neighbourhood in which he had chosen to make his home. It was extremely aggravating not to have thought of this idea herself, and she received the news of it with considerable indignation.
I consider it great presumption in them to hold such a dinner, she declared, and very much intended to serve their own interests. They mean to have Mr. Bingley for Charlotte, Mr. Bennet, I am sure of it. I've rarely seen such behaviour. I wonder they are not ashamed.
Then I shall write and explain we cannot attend, replied her husband. It would obviously be painful for you to witness their machinations at first hand.
Whatever are you thinking?
Cried his wife, exasperated.
Of course we must go. I won't see Jane cut out by that contriving Charlotte Lucas. I shan't take my eyes off her for a minute.
In that case, I shall convey our acceptance and look forward to what promises to be a most pleasant evening spent amongst our oldest and dearest friends.
Thus it was that Mary found herself, when the appointed evening rolled around, in an undistinguished seat at the least favoured end of Sir William's dining table, playing with her food and wishing the dinner over. From a rather better situation nearer Mr. Bingley and his friends, Charlotte occasionally caught her eye, her cheerfulness no longer seeming as natural as Mary had once assumed it to be. Her bleak confession at the ball echoed in Mary's mind as she surveyed the guests, all of whom appeared to be enjoying themselves with a gusto that grated on Mary's sombre frame of mind. Her mood darkened further as she watched the men gathered round the table, and it struck her very forcibly that not one of them would consider her as a potential wife. There was Mr. Bingley, working as hard to please as he had at the Meryton ball, all smiles and jollity and good nature. But for all his easygoing charm, Mary sensed he would never notice any woman who was not a beauty. And having Jane before his eyes, why would he look for anyone else? Mary rarely thought as one with Mrs. Bennet, but as she watched Mr. Bingley and Jane together, there seemed little doubt he was smitten with her. As her gaze moved on towards the grand and severe Mr. Darcy, Mary almost laughed at the sheer impossibility of his thinking of her in any way at all. He had not even registered the fact of her existence. She thought she saw him look sometimes in Elizabeth's direction, but Lizzie resolutely ignored him, his use of the fatal word tolerable woundingly fresh in her memory. At the other end of the table were a noisy group of young men in uniform, rather red in the face from too much wine, flirting with Kitty and Lydia. Mary found it impossible to tell them apart. She thought they were unlikely to be as particular as Mr. Bingley or his friend, but where good looks were not to be found, they required jolliness and tearingly high spirits, and Mary had neither. The truth was, she thought bitterly, that there was no one in her immediate society who considered her worthy of attention, And if this was so when she was still young, why should it improve as she grew older? In all likelihood, her next 10 years would be spent very much like Charlotte's lost decade, with little to hope for and not much to make her happy. As the evening went on, Mary felt herself steadily diminished by this knowledge, imagining herself fading from view, minute by minute, hour by hour, until she felt as though she had disappeared altogether, leaving nothing behind to remind anyone that she had ever been there at all. It was only when dinner was over, and the cloth cleared, that she rallied somewhat. Dancing was called for, and, seeing an opportunity to break out of her unhappiness, Mary volunteered to oblige the company at the piano. For the rest of the evening, she hammered out Scottish and Irish airs, whilst her sisters and the Lucases took to the floor with the keenest of the officers. When she could play no more, she received the thanks of the dancers with mixed emotions. She was glad to have done something other than sit in silence, but she felt she had purchased the gratitude of the party by absenting herself from their number. She thought she heard Charlotte reminding her how unprofitable it was to be content with warming your hands at the happiness of others, and it saddened her to think this might be her destiny, enabling pleasure for those around her, whilst never enjoying it herself. Chapter 20. It came as no surprise to Mary when a letter arrived for Jane at Longbourn from Miss Bingley, begging her to come to Netherfield to join the party there. They were sadly bored and longed for company. Perhaps she would drink tea with them. Could she also be persuaded to dine? Jane read the invitation to the family in her usual measured tones, but Mary saw that beneath her shyness she was pleased. Her mother, however, was almost beside herself with excitement.
"So much for Lady Lucas's plans! I knew he had no interest in Charlotte, and I was right. You must go on horseback, Jane. You shan't have the carriage. It looks as if it will rain later, and if it does, they will be compelled to offer you a bed. The longer you stay there, the better. What an opportunity for you!"
The protests of Jane and Elizabeth on this point went unheard. Jane was to ride, and that was that. The risk of a soaking was well worth the chance of securing another day as Mr. Bingley's guest. So Jane was dispatched, wearing only a cloak and light shoes. When the anticipated downpour arrived rather earlier than had been expected, there could be no doubt that Jane must have been caught in the deluge, but Mrs. Bennet was not in the least concerned.
"A little rain never hurt anyone, you know, and they will be obliged to keep her now."
Elizabeth, however, was far from being so sanguine. She was not at all confident her sister would survive her drenching unscathed, and when news reached Longbourn the next day that Jane was confined to bed with a chill, Elizabeth was consumed with anxiety. She begged for the use of the carriage to go immediately to attend her sister, but her mother was implacable.
"I'm not at all afraid of her dying. She will be taken good care of. As long as she stays there, all will be well."
Elizabeth submitted uneasily to Mrs. Bennet's will for most of the following day, but when no letter arrived announcing Jane's full recovery, she could stand it no more and declared her intention to walk the few miles to Netherfield to see for herself how Jane fared. She paid no attention to her mother's insistence that Lizzie was not wanted there, that she would merely get in the way, scuppering her carefully contrived plan. Mary listened as the arguments went back and forth, round and round. She could not see that Elizabeth's presence was as necessary as she thought. If Jane were really ill, surely a message would have been sent to that effect from Netherfield. And if Jane was indeed so unfortunate as to be seriously unwell, Lizzie's walking so far through muddy fields and wet roads to reach her did not make sense. She might become ill herself, and then what help could she be to Jane? "I admire the activity of your benevolence," she ventured quietly to Elizabeth, in as dispassionate a tone as she could muster. "But every impulse of feeling should be guided by reason, and surely exertion should always be in proportion to what is required." Elizabeth turned towards her, more angry than Mary could remember seeing her.
"That is a calculation I am happy I have made correctly," she said coldly. "So you need not trouble yourself further on my behalf, and I must disagree with you on the competing claims of reason and feeling. When not warmed up by feeling, reason is a very chilly, uncomfortable discipline by which to live your life." I am surprised to hear you speak in this way, Mary. It is most unappealing. I will leave as soon as I have put on my boots. I hope to be back for dinner. In fact, Elizabeth's return was by no means immediate. She found Jane in a condition which convinced her she could not be left until her recovery was more certain. And in this unintended manner, Lizzie found herself quite by chance a guest of the Netherfield house party, where she stayed for the better part of a week. When Jane was well enough to receive them, Mr. Bingley invited Mrs. Bennet and her younger daughters to come to Netherfield and visit Jane themselves, and all but Mary eagerly accepted. She was still smarting from Elizabeth's rebuke, and preferred to hide away at home. It had been painful enough to feel herself the object of her favourite sister's scorn. It was worse to realise that Elizabeth had been quite right to scold her, for Jane had indeed been as ill as she feared. Lizzie's heart had been a better guide to what was best for Jane than Mary's cool reasoning. Mary was ashamed of what she had said, and did not feel ready yet to find herself in Lizzie's company. Instead, she stayed behind at Longbourn, walking alone in the garden, and blaming herself for having made yet another wrong judgment, for having spoken when she had far better have said nothing at all. It was here Charlotte Lucas found her when she called to find out how Jane did. "I hope," she said, "that Jane has not allowed her illness to prevent her making the most of her time at Netherfield. It would be a pity if it has distracted her from achieving the main purpose of her visit." "I believe Miss Bingley asked her principally as company for herself and her sister. I think they felt the need of a new face at the card table." "That may have been how the invitation was worded," replied Charlotte knowingly. "But depend upon it, that was not their only motive in summoning Jane to them. They would never have asked her if they were not convinced of their brother's partiality for her. I suspect they wished to see for themselves what manner of woman she is." They had arrived at a little bench situated under a quince tree. Charlotte sat down and motioned for Mary to join her. "So you believe it was Jane's task to do all she could to win his sister's friendship and seek their approval?" "Undoubtedly, that can do no harm, and may indeed do a great deal of good." Charlotte loosened the ribbon on her hat and let it rest on the back of her head. "But," she continued, "the liking of a man's sisters cannot compare with his own feelings on the matter. Jane has been given an extraordinary opportunity to make Mr. Bingley aware of the strength of her regard. I do hope for her sake that she has taken full advantage of it." "I know your opinions in these matters," said Mary, "but I'm not sure Jane's attachment is strong enough to justify such bravery. I could not say what she truly feels for Mr. Bingley. If she is not yet sure that she loves him, she can hardly be expected to persuade him that is the case." "On the contrary, I should say that is exactly when such a declaration is most required. Delay may be fatal to her chances. It's plain to everyone that she likes him and enjoys his company. What else can she require? She may lose him altogether if she fails to fix him now. If it's love that she wants, well, she stands as good a chance of finding it with him as with anyone else." "Do you really think so little of the tender emotions, Charlotte? She hardly knows him. How can she possibly be certain he would make her happy?" Charlotte bent down and plucked several long blades of grass. "I sometimes wonder whether you have truly absorbed any of the ideas contained in those books you read with such enthusiasm. As I recall, most of their authors insist it is companionship that forms the basis of a truly happy marriage. Passion, they tell us, is very soon spent, and is anyway a most uncertain foundation for domestic felicity." She began to plait the grass together, fixing all her attention upon her task as she spoke. "You may talk like a rational creature, but beneath that disciplined exterior hides a true romantic nature. You keep it well concealed, but it makes an appearance every now and then before you rush to snuff it out." Mary blushed. "No, not at all. I merely wondered whether a marriage can be embarked upon with any real possibility of happiness if the husband and wife know so little of each other when they begin. And if one or both of them pretends to feelings they do not yet possess, then surely that cannot promise well for their future." "I see we will never agree. But I do assure you that happiness in marriage is entirely a matter of chance. If Jane were to be studying Mr. Bingley's character for another year, it would make no difference. She has as good an opportunity of being happy with him as with any other man she might meet, and for that reason, I hope she has seized as fully as she can the opportunity of these last few days. I wish her success with all my heart, but if she has failed to build on her advantage, well, she has no one to blame but herself. In her position, I would not let such a chance slip through my fingers.
Tell me, Charlotte, are you really so unhappy, situated as you are?
Charlotte threw her grass plat upon the ground and stood up. I cannot pretend my feelings have altered since we last spoke. Come, shall we find Mrs. Hill and see if she can be persuaded to offer us tea?
Chapter 21. It was another week until Jane was well enough to return home, and some days after that before she was allowed downstairs. Mrs. Bennet showed no remorse for what had happened, meeting Elizabeth's reproachful looks with an indignant assertion that Jane would thank her once she was married. She was sure it could not be long before Mr. Bingley made his declaration. It was therefore not surprising that, when one morning at breakfast Mr. Bennet announced that he hoped she had ordered a good dinner for that night, since he expected the arrival of a guest, Mrs. Bennet's mind leapt immediately to the possibility, the very exciting possibility, of its being Mr. Bingley. But her husband immediately corrected her.
"I am sorry to disappoint you, my dear. It is not he, but another young man who will grace us with his presence later today. I speak of my cousin, Mr. Collins, who, when I am dead, may turn you all out of this house as soon as he pleases."
As Mr. Bennet had intended, his words provoked general astonishment and surprise. Everyone spoke at once, deluging him with questions until he was obliged to hold up his hand and ask for quiet. Only then, and at a pace of his own choosing, did he reveal the story behind their unexpected visitor's impending arrival. It appeared that a month earlier, Mr. Bennet had received a letter from his cousin proposing himself as a guest.
"About a fortnight ago I answered it, for I thought it a case of some delicacy that it required early attention. Should you like to hear what it says?"
He put on his glasses, and with a flourish extracted the letter from a pocket of his coat. It covered many pages, and Mr. Bennet read it in a manner as slow and pompous as the language in which it was written. Mr. Collins began by regretting the breach which had for so long subsisted between Mr. Bennet and his father. However, now that his revered parent was no more, he thought it incumbent upon him, if it lay within his poor powers, to heal the hurt inflicted by this quarrel. His recent ordination had made him feel the desirability of a reconciliation even more strongly. "He observes," continued Mr. Bennet,
"that, as a clergyman, I feel it my duty to promote the blessings of peace in all families within my influence." He goes on, "and I think this will be of particular interest to you, my dear, that on these grounds I flatter myself that my present overtures of goodwill are highly commendable, and the circumstances of my being next in the entail of the Longbourn estate will be kindly overlooked on your part, and not lead you to reject the offered olive branch."
Mrs. Bennet threw down her napkin, scattering breadcrumbs from her plate.
"I think it very impertinent of him to write to you at all, and very hypocritical. I hate such false friends."
"I fear you are too unkind to him. He acknowledges his sin just as fully as you could wish. He says he is concerned at being the means of injuring your amiable daughters, and indeed begs leave to apologize for it. Indeed, he professes his readiness to make them every possible amends, but of this hereafter."
"What can he mean by that?"
asked Mrs. Bennet, a little mollified now.
"I shall not discourage him if he means to do something material for the girls. What more has he to say?"
"There is more. Much more, as it happens. But nothing further on that point. He tells us a great deal about his good fortune in securing a valuable living in Kent, and of his indebtedness to the bounty and beneficence of his worthy patroness,
the Right Honourable Lady Catherine de Bourgh, widow of Sir Louis de Bourgh. Towards this lady, he informs us, it will always be his endeavour to demean myself with grateful respect. Finally, you will all no doubt be relieved to understand that his visit has been made with her ladyship's entire and wholehearted approval, since he has already engaged some other clergyman to do his duty in his absence.
He folded up the letter and tapped it on the table.
We may expect this peacemaking gentleman at 4 o'clock today. I very much look forward to making his acquaintance.
He must be an oddity, I think, declared Elizabeth. I cannot make him out. There is something very pompous in his style. What can he mean by apologizing for the entail? Can he be a sensible man, sir?
No, my dear, I do not think he can. There is a mixture of servility and self-importance in his letter which promises very well. I am impatient to see him.
Mr. Bennet looked around the table with genuine anticipation, and Mary felt a twinge of sympathy for the hapless Mr. Collins. His intentions seemed to her honourable, if perhaps not very happily conveyed. In point of composition, she suggested, his letter does not seem entirely defective. The idea of the olive branch perhaps is not wholly new, yet I think it is well expressed. Her words made no impact at all. The conversation had grown loud again, as the probable motives for Mr. Collins' visit were enthusiastically debated, not, on the whole, much to his credit. He appears to mean nothing but good in coming here, she continued, raising her voice against the hubbub. Is it right to condemn him before we have even met him? No one listened. After a while, Mary stood up, pushed her chair back neatly into place, made a respectful nod to her parents, and left the table. As she walked down the hall, she could still hear the family talking. She thought it probable that no one had even noticed her absence. Later that afternoon, the object of all this discussion arrived, exactly on time. He was a tall, heavy-looking young man in his mid-twenties, with a solemn and stately air. His voice was rather louder and his manners stiffer and more formal than a family drawing-room required. But the more he spoke, the more he pleased his hosts. Mrs. Bennet was delighted to be addressed with all the respectful consideration she felt was her due, whilst her husband was equally gratified to find their visitor in every way as ridiculous as he had hoped. Mr. Collins's compliments to his fair cousins, his pleasure at discovering their good looks, far exceeded even the most enthusiastic reports. His conviction they must expect to be very quickly and advantageously disposed of in marriage were not much to the taste of those to whom they were addressed. They were, however, music to their mother's ears, though she could not resist observing it was very unfortunate they should have no proper portions to bring with them to their husbands, things being settled so oddly.
You allude, perhaps, murmured Mr. Collins, to the entail of this estate?
Yes, sir. It is a very vexing situation.
I could say much on the subject, he observed,
grinning at his cousins with a particularly arch and irritating smirk.
But I am cautious of appearing forward and precipitate. But I can assure the young ladies I come prepared to admire them. At present, I will not say any more, but perhaps when we are better acquainted.
Jane and Elizabeth looked sternly away, whilst Kitty and Lydia did not try to hide their boredom. Only Mary looked at him with curiosity. It could not be denied that he did not make a very impressive figure. He had none of the swagger of the officers Kitty and Lydia so admired, nor the cheerful warmth of Mr. Bingley, and he certainly possessed nothing of Mr. Darcy's natural gravity, the authority and assurance that commanded deference wherever he appeared. As she watched him talking to her mother, admiring the disposition of the rooms, the elegance of the furniture, and the colour of the curtains, it was hard not to find him foolish. Everything delighted him. He seemed not to understand where appreciation ended and flattery began. Yet, for all his obsequiousness, he frequently failed to please. He seemed not to notice that Mrs. Bennet did not like to hear her sofas compared to those which his esteemed patroness, Lady Catherine de Bourgh, had placed in her second-best morning-room. He would do better, Mary thought, to say less and think more. But as he rambled on, she understood that would never happen. He would always condemn himself out of his own mouth, and would do so in complete ignorance of the poor impression he made. She began to feel apprehensive on his behalf about how he would fare at dinner. Mr. Collins offered her father such a tempting opportunity for exercising his wit that she could not imagine any circumstances in which he would forego it.